Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another new episode of the Gals of Geekdom podcast. I am one of your hosts, Crystal Williams. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm joined by my equally amazing, talented, employed co-host, Jazzy.
Hello.
Jazzy? Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. How are you today?
Doing pretty all right, honestly.
Doing okay, which is good. I heard that there is a new thing that came onto Netflix. A new, queer thing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain said queer thing?
So... after years of waiting, a potential cancellation, and everything going on, and just Disney being terrible, Nimona, the animated film based on N.D. Stevenson's graphic novel, finally released. It is on Netflix for everyone to enjoy.
Huzzah! I think everyone was like it was in production, right? And people thought it was like canceled, right? Like that's kind of where it was.
Yeah.
That's kind of like, I remember hearing about it and how sad people were. But then Netflix surprisingly saved it.
Yeah, so for, if you don't know the history of this film, it was originally going to be a movie made by Blue Sky. But then Disney acquired it and Blue Sky got shut down. And this film got canned along with it. Now, many reports differ on why it happened, though. One consistent is that when Blue Sky animators were talking with Disney execs about the film, they did receive pushback because Nimona, the graphic novel, as well as this film, have a lot of queer themes. There are openly gay characters. There's even, minor spoiler, it does feature a gay kiss. There is a lot of gay, which should not be surprised if you are in any way familiar with Stevenson's work. Not only did he make this graphic novel, he was also the showrunner for Netflix's own She-Ra series, which is also very gay.
Wait, are you telling me a show with a cat girl is gay?
Right.
Shocking. Wait, are you telling me a show based on an 80s TV show that's a spinoff of a famously gay show would also be gay?
Yes.
Oh. Now, that doesn't make any sense. That's very confusing. I don't know why they would do that. We all know for any queerness and anything to exist, there has to be a very logical explanation for it to exist. It can't just exist, you know. You have to give reasons, because otherwise you're shoving your beliefs down our throats.
Pretty much. So basically, yeah. This film got shut down. So this film got shut down. Basically, according to people behind it, the film was about like 70% done at this point. But it was shut down, and it looked like it wasn't happening. But until news came last year where another animation studio was saying, hey, we're going to finish the movie. Excuse me. We're going to take the 70% that's completed and pretty much work on finishing this movie, polish it up a bit, and it's going to go on Netflix, basically. It was released straight to streaming, and now we finally have it. And my final verdict is that Disney can go fuck themselves.
That is actually a very rational verdict considering the potentialness for which I don't doubt for the homophobia that was involved in the cancellation of said project. I think it's very funny that another Stevenson project ended up going through Netflix.
Right,
like that's weirdly coincidental in kind of a funny way.
Mm-hmm. So I think the appeal of this movie, a lot of the appeal of this movie comes from two things for me. One is the very unique visual style. If you've seen any trailer of this movie, you know, it's kind of going for a semi 2D, 3D mix type of deal. Like the models and stuff are 3D, but the expressions are very much reminiscent of a 2D animated film.
Yeah.
They're very exaggerated. They're cartoony. They're very expressive. And I think it works very well for this. But the other thing I feel is the character of Nimona herself. And without spoiling why, a lot of this character connected with me in a way that I hadn't found from another movie this year. Like, and because of that, I'm going to say, and this might be a hot take, this is my favorite film for 2023 so far. I liked it more than Spider-Verse. And keep in mind, I fucking love Spider-Verse. I wasn't expecting anything to beat it until Miyazaki's final movie came out this year.
I forgot Miyazaki's movie's coming out too.
Right, like I was expecting Spider-Verse to remain high up on that throne. And, like, just stay there, and the only thing that would be a threat to it is Miyazaki. But no, this movie came out, and I was just... I love the energy of it as well. Like, this movie never fucking drags. There are times where it slows down, but there aren't any moments where I feel like it's kind of going a bit too slow at some points. So it keeps a consistent energy that was very reminiscent of... I remember Emperor's New Groove came to my mind a lot in terms, if you want a comparison for kind of the manic energy it's going for.
Okay. Yeah, Emperor's New Groove has an incredible pace, too. Mm-hmm. Like, that movie moves quickly, so that's kind of exciting.
Right.
Did you read the original comic?
I've never read the original graphic novel, but similar to when I saw Scott Pilgrim years ago, this makes me want to read it.
I read a little bit of it. I got distracted, but I like the energy that was in that comic. And from the little bits I've seen of the trailer, it seems like it captured that.
Mm-hmm.
At least the characterization.
Oh, yeah. And this movie's also very funny. There were many times I laughed, and thankfully it kept a good balance between the stuff that's funny and the stuff that's, like, serious. They're not going to do that MCU thing I hate where they break a serious moment with a shitty joke. Like, there's a clear distinction between when you're having fun and when the movie's taking a moment to understand that there's a weight to everything happening.
Right. That's good. Mm-hmm. I mean, She-Ra balanced that well too.
Yes. It was very reminiscent of She-Ra in regards to that balance. The voice performances were also great, and on the topic of She-Ra, Shadow Weaver's voice actress actually voices a part in that, and I recognized her almost immediately.
Oh, okay, that's cool. It's Chloe Grace Moretz, right, as the lead?
No. Yeah, she plays the lead.
Yes.
Yeah, but Shadow Weaver's actress plays, like, the queen of the...
Yeah, you know, I know who you're talking about. I just was saying the lead is...
Yeah.
Chloe Grace Moretz.
Yeah, it's Chloe Grace Moretz and Riz Ahmed, who both do a fantastic job. Moretz especially was great, but Ahmed, geez. It's kind of funny because the first film I recall ever seeing him in was Venom, and he was one of the worst parts of that movie. And now every time I see him in a movie after it, he's genuinely phenomenal. So,
I mean, a lot of... A lot of performances based on the direction that they're given. So, and he is a fantastic actor.
Oh yeah, like
so. And I haven't seen Sound of Metal, but I heard that's great.
I still need to watch the English dub for Weathering with You, which he also voiced in. So.
Oh, that's right. He was in that. Yeah. He was good in that.
Yeah, I only ever saw the Japanese version of that movie. So.
Oh, okay. I saw it in English. Yeah.
Okay. But I really like this movie's overall themes of, like, identity, isolation, prejudice, finding yourself. There's a lot that I feel like really spoke to me, and I think will speak to a lot of queer audiences. It's very fitting this came out at the end of Pride Month, where, especially this Pride Month, where everything is just, like, going so shitty, like... I feel like this was kind of a movie that was needed at this time, and I know it wasn't intended by the folks who made it, but to have this great timing, but it worked, and I think it made the film better. Not that I think I'd like it less if I saw it like at any other year or time. And this movie really shows to me that corporations really are just the antithesis to art at this point, because you had this film, this wonderful movie that was 70% complete, and Disney decided it wasn't going to be released because there was gay shit in it and the creative forces were not, like, backing down on keeping the gay shit in it.
Well, removing the gay shit would remove a big part of
its exactly
heart, right?
Exactly.
Like, it would,
you can't do it without it. Like, that's it's why Stevenson's works are so good, because you can't, there's, like, queer theming and ideas are constantly the backbone of every story, that if you removed it, you'd pretty much be removing the soul of the movie or show. I feel the same thing. I feel the same way with She-Ra in that regard.
Yeah. I think that is a major reason why that show works as well as it does, and also why it has a big following, you know. Mm-hmm. It's very obvious a queer artist expressing themselves in a medium and doing so in a positive way. And I think you're right. We need expressions of queer joy in artistry. Mm-hmm. I think what you were saying about we need things like this, as much as we need things that get us up to fight, to push back against the oppressive forces that want to eliminate queer people, we simultaneously need these expressions of artistic joy and freedom and love as a way to keep us moving forward.
Mm-hmm. It is, but yeah, so, and one thing I also liked, and one thing I'm noticing a lot with animated movies recently, I am so happy that the PG rating's kind of being reclaimed instead of just being slightly edgier G.
Oh, yeah.
Between this and, like, The Last Wish and other films, it feels like the PG finally has a PG-rated films have a fucking backbone.
I mean, Spider-Verse had...
Yep, Spider-Verse was another one.
Had him cursing a few times for...
Yeah.
For a PG movie, hearing the character say damn and ass was like, whoa. That's different.
Yeah. It's funny because animated movies are suddenly remembering, oh, right, we can have minor swear words if we want to, just so long as we don't get crazy with it.
Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to ever get a PG-rated movie that did what the animated Transformers movie did in the 80s with
a character saying shit.
Oh, shit.
I mean, I guess The Last Wish kind of got away with it. They just bleeped it.
Oh, okay. Well... But not flat out saying it.
Right. But still, the bleeping was still surprising and hilarious, so.
It was funny, yeah. I do love that. The in the 80s, they were just like, wait, we're making a movie.
Well, like, it's because, like, the PG-13 didn't exist yet, like, for a lot of these cases, so.
Right, I mean, it's so wild how, like, restricted the rating systems has become over the years. Like, in the 80s, where you're like, oh yeah, you can just have someone topless in a PG-rated movie, you know?
Yeah.
I'm looking at you, Airplane. And you can't even get away with that now in a PG-13 movie.
No. But yeah, it's kind of interesting seeing these movies actually kind of have a bit more in terms of their violence and also, like, having a bit more language and just still keeping the PG rating. And I think Nimona definitely keeps that going. If I had any problem with this movie, and this is just me, if you want me to fucking nitpick, like, go in, scrape everything and find something I could theoretically bitch about if I really wanted to, I do think the plot is a little predictable in places. But within the context of what they're doing and how it resonates with the themes, it's not bothersome. And I think enough unpredictable happens within the visuals and humor that it kind of makes up for it.
That's fair. I can't wait to see it myself. I'm a little behind, but I will definitely be watching it. If not tonight, I'll watch it tomorrow. But I think a lot of us need art like that. You know, that's fun. It's queer, exciting. It's fresh. I know a lot of our listeners love animation, so it sounds like you give it your the jazzy stamp of approval.
Yes.
We need an official stamp that you can, like, mark on things, you know.
It's better than a lot of it. Let's just say this month, at like June, was kind of a month for movies for me. So
yeah, that's fair. When did Spider-Verse come out? Was that June?
June was Spider-Verse was like the start of June, so it got me my expectations high for the rest of the month.
Oh, okay, gotcha. I see what you're saying. Yeah,
because throughout the month I saw Rise of the Beasts, Asteroid City, The Flash, and Elemental, and all of them ranged from decent to I'm annoyed that your writing is so blatantly awful in terms of Elemental. That might be too harsh, but
I have not seen it yet, so I can't make a judgment outside of, since working at a movie theater, occasionally I'll walk into a screening and it's on and I see a scene, I'm like, eh. Yeah. Nothing grabs me.
It is one of the most generic animated movies ever, and while I appreciate the allegorical backbone it has, which seems to be the appeal for people who enjoy this movie, I think it's not well written at all. And I'm trying not to step on too many toes, because I know, like, the allegory of the film spoke to a lot of people, and that's nice. I just think it was badly handled, and I think the world building was shit, which in a movie like this, world building is everything to me.
I'm very curious to hear what your take on would be if you saw the, is it Ruby Gilman movie? Because I'm getting a similar vibe, but not exactly, you know what I mean?
That movie, I'm probably, like, just judging from the trailers, I'm just going to say, I might see that movie at some point because I really dig the character designs for it, but I don't expect much from it on the writing side.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I'm not sure how to feel, but I just know that it's playing now, so I didn't even know it was coming out.
By the way, I saw Asteroid City last week as well, and that was my first Wes Anderson film.
So I haven't seen Asteroid City, but how was your experience watching a Wes Anderson film for the first time?
Why does everyone talk like a robot?
Okay. That's the style.
I just don't get it. Like, I was so annoyed with how everyone had the dullest performance except for Jeffrey Wright, who was kind of going all out. But
I think based on reviews and what I've seen, I think I'll probably like the movie, but I don't think this was the prime example of a Wes Anderson movie to start with. You know?
That's what a lot of, like, Wes Anderson fans are telling me. They were like, oh, Jazzy, this should not have been your first Anderson film.
My first was Moonrise Kingdom, and I actually liked that enough. And I saw Grand Budapest Hotel afterwards, and I actually love Grand Budapest Hotel. It's so quirky. And
I've had Grand Budapest Hotel on my shelf for, like, a year or so.
Well, Now you have to watch that one to compare it, because that one's a damn good movie. It's really interesting. It's funny. He does have that, like, same robotic approach to the way in which his performers do. But I think in a lot of cases, that's kind of a tool for comedy, especially in that film. I think them acting so, like, uninterested in the most, like, weird of scenarios sometimes really heightens the comedy that's in a lot of his works. I also recommend you see Fantastic Mr. Fox. I thought that was really good, too.
I heard that one was great. But no, my problem with this movie is, like, yeah, there's some weird stuff that happens, but, like, No, everyone has kind of this dull reaction to everything, not just the weird stuff. Like, even in conversations, everyone sounds so robotic. Like, before I went to see this, I heard people singling out Scarlett Johansson's performance as the highlight of the movie. And I really have to wonder why, because she sounded so bored along with most of the other cast. So
I think that's just the aesthetic style that Anderson chooses. And I can understand it not being for, like, everyone. I need to see it for myself, though, to, like, see what you're talking about, really. I don't think anyone in his films particularly give amazing performances, but I do think they give appropriately Anderson performances, if that makes sense.
Also, this is the first film I ever nearly fell asleep during, if that's an indication of how bored I was.
Oh, I'm sorry. I bet there's another Anderson film you'd like more. I think you'd probably like Budapest Hotel more. I've heard The Royal Tenenbaums is good, but I haven't seen it myself.
I heard that one was good.
Yeah, I liked Fantastic Mr. Fox, Moonrise Kingdom, and Grand Budapest are the three that I've seen, and I liked all of them. And I've heard good things about Isle of Dogs, but I've been meaning to go back to, but I just haven't seen it. That's one of his two animated films.
Yeah, and it's one of the only animated films to receive a Criterion release.
I forgot I got a Criterion.
Yeah, it's one of three. The other two being Watership Down and WALL-E.
Fantastic Mr. Fox is Criterion too.
Yeah, that's what I said. Criterion. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant for Isle of Dogs.
No, Isle of Dogs has not gotten a Criterion release, as far as I know.
Oh, okay. You would think it would, considering Criterion really likes Anderson's filmography.
Right, right. They usually take a bit to get to a release on that, like to get to Criterion releases of any film. So.
Yeah, I have the Criterion release of Mr. Fox, and I have a regular release of Budapest, I think. I don't know. I think I should get a Criterion Budapest. I think I bought the regular release of Budapest, not thinking it was going to go to Criterion, because I just like the movie, you know? Mm-hmm.
Also, throughout the last month, I watched a few movies not from this year, like a couple movies not from this year that I've seen for the very first time, so...
Which movie?
Okay, so there's three. I'm going to go with the worst right away. So my friends and I in our movie night group kind of do a bad movie-a-thon. And it usually is supposed to last to April, but this one just lasted into June, like because there was a lot of delays and people were busy and so forth.
Yeah, that's understandable.
So I saw Jack and Jill for the first time.
Oh, Dunkachino?
Yeah, that the only good part. Like, if... I'm going to say this right now. It's a 1 out of 10 movie, and that one is the Dunkachino. If it wasn't for that, this would be an easy zero.
Wait, do you genuinely like the scene, or do you just like how, like, bad it is? Like,
here's the thing about the Dunkachino that I love. Unlike everything else in the movie, the Dunkachino is intentionally dumb and bad. Like, so.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And, like, seeing him dance and do this dumb rap that was clearly just there to advertise Dunkin' Donuts, which is the only reason this film exists, it was a lot of fun, and it was the only time in this film I was feeling anything other than hate.
The only time where I didn't feel seething rage.
And that's not an exaggeration. This movie, like, you've probably heard people say how awful it is. And, you know, sometimes when I hear about how bad movies are, when people say this is the worst of all time, I try to go in to be fair. And sometimes I go, you know what? It wasn't as bad as people say. I'm someone who goes up to bat for films like Batman and Robin, Sucker Punch, all these critically maligned movies. And that I actually ended up enjoying. Hell, I even kind of liked Wild Wild West. So
I grew up on Wild Wild West, so that still has a place in my heart, because I was a kid when I saw that.
This is the first movie I've seen in a long time that was as bad as everyone said it was. Like, I was not, in a way, I wasn't disappointed, so there's that. No, it was definitely as bad as people were telling me. It was just, it was so bad. It was also, fun fact, the friend who submitted it for his entry for this bad movie-a-thon gave me money afterwards because of all the, as an apology, because he didn't realize the film had so much transphobia.
Oh, so there's a lot, huh?
Oh, there is. It's like, and it's not even, I was expecting some just on the base premise that the premise of the movie is that Adam Sandler's in drag, but holy shit.
Is it transphobia in the way where they like mock trans people existing, or is it more like transphobia in the way where it's like through the way that they talk about Seth's character?
That one, because,
okay. I just was curious. Like, I didn't know which, cause I've, going back and watching like, Arrested Development. I love that show, but there's some really harsh transphobia in some episodes. Like, it's bad.
But even if the transphobia wasn't there, it would still be a god-awful movie for one reason, and I can tell you what reason. It's not funny, and that's the worst thing a comedy can do.
Unfortunately, Adam Sandler is good at making not funny comedies.
There was, outside of the Dunkachino, there was one joke in the movie that I legitimately laughed at.
What was the joke?
So there's a scene where – so the whole premise of the movie is Adam Sandler's trying to set up his twin sister with Al Pacino, obviously playing himself in this movie.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And in order to get a sponsor deal, Jill is not interested, so Jack decides to go in dressed up as Jill, basically. And there's a scene where he goes into the bathroom. It's not going to go where you think. I was very worried it was going to go, but hear me out for a second.
Okay.
Goes in the bathroom, gets all dolled up, gets in drag and everything. And he goes out and because they're on a cruise, there's a restroom valet and he sees him and he just signals him to come over here. And you're wondering, what the fuck is he doing? And he just helps adjust his fake boobs.
Oh,
cause they weren't aligned properly. And I thought that was very funny.
Okay.
Because it was surprisingly wholesome.
Okay. So that wasn't bad.
And then they ruin it later by having the same joke with Jill, and because he mistook her for the brother, and it, they ruined the joke. They ruined the one good joke.
They ruined it. You bastards, you blew it all to hell.
Yeah. It was an absolutely joyless experience. I think it's also an interesting movie in that it's the first and only film in the Razzie history to pretty much win every award that was presented that night. Most of them I won't dispute, but there are two I will heavily dispute. Actually, three. There are three I will heavily dispute. Worst actress for Adam Sandler, because that's just not funny. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Worst supporting actor for Al Pacino, because I'm going to be real. He was probably the best performance in the movie.
Yeah, Razzies do that sort of thing where they don't actually look at, like, the quality of the performance, more so, like, just who they can pick for to be the most controversial, you know?
And the third one I dispute is worst remake, ripoff, or sequel, because according to the Razzies, this is a ripoff of Ed Wood's Glenn or Glenda, which it's not. The only commonality between them is that the lead actor's in drag. That's it.
Also, that's kind of, like, really shitty, considering Ed Wood's, like, genuine connection to drag, and probably, if it was, I think if Ed lived today, I think his story would have been different. Let's just say, I definitely think Ed was queer. So I think Glenn or Glenda was an expression of queerness. So that's offensive in its own right.
But yeah, this was horrible. It was as bad as everyone told me. And needless to say, that friend won the bad movie-a-thon for this year. So
yeah.
And it wasn't even a contest, because none of the other movies, the other three of us entered for consideration, were nearly as bad. One guy had The Lawnmower Man, the other had Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, which was fucking horrendous.
Okay. But,
and I submitted the Lion King remake, so.
Okay. So anyway. those were worse?
Yeah. No, Jack and Jill were worse.
That's what I mean. Sorry, I meant to say Jack and Jill.
Yeah, Jack and Jill was worse than all three of those, and by a landslide, like with averaging the scores, like because I averaged everyone's scores out of 10, and this one by a fucking landslide. So,
thank you for watching it, so I don't have to.
Yeah, in terms of the other films I saw this month for the first time, I watched Swiss Army Man, which is the first the directorial debut of the Daniels, who would later go on to do Everything Everywhere All at Once.
That's been on my my watch list for a little while. Did you say? I think I saw your Letterboxd review. You did a Letterboxd review of that?
Yes, I did.
Okay, I did see it cross my feed. Okay, and it seems like you liked it a lot.
I did, and I'm shocked that the farting Daniel Radcliffe corpse movie was as profound and emotional as it was. Like, I actually found myself in awe at the film. And I know that's a weird thing to say given this film's premise, but I mean it without the slightest sense of irony.
Seems like the Daniels in their two films use these weird sort of sequences, concepts, and unique ideas to deliver messages that are incredibly wholesome and emotional.
Mm-hmm. And then the other film I saw was A Star is Born. I finally watched that one.
That movie was good. Yeah, I saw it in theaters when it came out.
I only had one thing to say after the film was over.
Yeah, but
why do I hurt?
Yeah, it was definitely a rough one.
Mm.
It is a rough movie. It's not a movie you watch to end happy, you know.
Right. This is a movie I really liked, but it's kind of one of those movies where if I ever rewatch it, I have to be in a certain mood. Like,
it's also hard to recommend. Like, it's easy to say it's a great piece of art, but it's also not easy to like recommend it to people based on like how harsh it is.
Absolutely. It is a hard movie to recommend I mean that in the best way. Like,
yeah, no, there's some films that are just really emotionally like difficult, and that film is definitely one of them. I liked it too. I thought it was extremely well made. I thought Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga's performances were phenomenal. I mean, vocal wise too, their songs were phenomenal as well.
Look, I'm just gonna say I teared up when they sang "Shallow," and as soon as I realized I was tearing up during that scene, I realized, oh fuck, I'm not gonna make it through the rest of this movie emotionally okay.
I teared up during "Shallow" as well. That's a beautiful song.
Mm. So yeah, that one was very good. That one was very good.
Yes, at least you had some really good movies to offset the Jack and Jill in the Room.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, we also watched through the John Wick series during June. So,
oh, the John Wick movies were cool. Did you see 4 already?
Yeah. I watched them all. I watched them all for the first time ever this month. I had not seen them before, and I can safely say some of my favorite action movies ever made. So.
I agree. Do you have a favorite of the 4?
Chapter 4 is my personal favorite.
Okay, I don't blame you. I don't know which one would be mine, but I do think 4, and I don't want to spoil it for people who still haven't seen it. It's been out for a little while, but I don't want to completely spoil it, but I think some of the most impressive and technical stunt work I've ever seen in a film, like ever. Like, absolutely insanity in that regard.
Oh yeah, it's great. And it's one of those franchises that shockingly I felt each film only got better and better as it went along. So
more bold.
Yeah.
Took more risks, I'd say. Tried to outdo each one. I'm impressed by that series. It showed a real commitment to the craft. There's a lot of love, you know. I was just impressed. Like I've seen a lot of films who are like films that are like stunt films, you know, like with like stunt performers who do action sequences. But sometimes those films can have the direction that and like cinematography that don't necessarily benefit it, even if the talented crew behind it is putting a lot of work into it in terms of the stunt work. But I feel like these films managed to find that really good balance, you know? Mm. Like, visually impressive cinematography, shot composition, storytelling, while also having the most technically amazing fight sequences I've probably ever seen in a movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. there's a sequence in the latter half where I'm just like, holy shit. Like, this action scene has been going on for like 40 minutes. And I'm not mad about that. I think that's cool. Also, have you seen The Warriors?
The Warriors?
The Warriors, the film.
No, I have not.
I bring that up because the last act of John Wick 4 is an homage to The Warriors. Like, right down to, mild spoiler, the woman who's doing those radio announcement calls, that's directly ripped from The Warriors. Like, the shot is even the same, where you just see her lips. It's exactly the same. I was watching, I'm like, holy shit, this is The Warriors. Because the concept of The Warriors, do you know anything about it? Do you know?
I do not.
Okay, so The Warriors, I'm sure you're familiar with the game and stuff. And you know it's about a gang, right?
I think. I've heard nothing about this movie, so...
Oh, you've not? Okay, so I'm just asking because there is a pretty popular... Rockstar made a video game in, like, for PS2. So The Warriors, 1970s film. It's kind of like an action thriller. The concept is somewhat future-ish, New York-ish, like a sort of fantastical version of New York, where all the different boroughs are basically controlled by different street gangs. And you follow 9 members of the Warriors crew. Like, there's a bunch more, but you follow 9 of them as each gang is basically called to Central Park by this guy named Osiris, who has a proposal for every gang in basically in New York. The proposal being that we're all separate and divided, but we could all come together to basically control New York. So basically a bunch of delegates are from each gang. The problem is there is one crew who decides in his infinite wisdom and just his own psychotic state to bring a gun to this rally, which he's not supposed to have. He shoots and kills Osiris in the middle of the crowd while everyone was willing to work together, and then pins it on the Warriors. So the film is following the Warriors as they desperately try and make their way back alive from Central Park to Coney Island, where their turf is.
Interesting.
It's a great movie. It's a great little movie. But throughout the movie, you have this radio announcer character who pops in as somewhat of the narrator, but also a way of means of, like, literally going, oh, the Warriors made it past this crew. You know, just like kind of in John Wick, what happens. Which is, it's really interesting that, like, John Wick was like, yeah, I'm just going to take from the Warriors and do it again. but, like, in a way that very obviously they loved it and inspired by it. I do think you should see that movie. I think you would like it. It's a good movie. Walter Hill directed it. It's got a really, really good visual style, great music. It's pretty intense in a good way. I think you would dig it. I even think you might like the game, even if it's a bit dated.
All right.
The game is a prequel.
Okay.
So you learn more about them. But, yeah, so... And just fun fact, if you didn't realize that John Wick was, like, the last act is a giant homage to the Warriors.
I'm not surprised, considering there's a lot of sequences in these films that are homages, so...
Yeah, no, it's not surprising, but it was very obvious to me as someone when I was younger, I used to watch that movie a lot. I watched it, like, over and over again because I really liked it. I used to watch more. There used to be a selection of movies I had that I just watched over and over again. The Warriors being one of them. Kung Pao being one of them. Star Wars. You know, as I've gotten older, it's hard to do that. But when you're young and you don't have the responsibilities, you know, it's good. So yes, I'm glad we both agree that John Wick rules the whole series.
Yeah, there's a lot of homages. Like, there was in one of the films, I forget which one, there was like a top-down like action sequence, and the way it
that's in four.
Yeah, and the way it was framed reminded me a lot of the hallway fight in Old Boy.
Oh, like, yeah, you're right. It also reminds me of, like, what's that game, Hotline Miami?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But it is framed a little bit like Old Boy, which that sequence in Old Boy is phenomenal too.
It is. I mean, of course I'm going to recognize Old Boy influence because it's one of my favorites, so.
Yeah, that whole sequence is amazing. I didn't see the remake, but I don't really care to.
Do not watch the okay, Crystal. The remake is god fucking awful. No one involved liked how it turned out. Spike Lee even removed his like trademark, a Spike Lee joint, from the film's So no one gave a shit about this movie. It is a movie that exists for a paycheck for people. That is the reason it exists.
That does kind of stink, because Spike Lee is a talented filmmaker. And it's Josh Brolin, right?
Yeah, and Josh Brolin is shockingly horrendous in this movie.
Oh, really? That's a shame, because he's such a good actor.
Like, I'd argue it's the worst performance he's ever delivered, like, bar none.
Oh, that's such a shame.
Then again, most of the performances were bad. I think the only one who managed to come out with a slightly decent performance was Samuel L. Jackson. So.
Well, Sam somehow manages in most of his films to come out with a good performance. Mm-hmm. Like, I think the only time I've ever seen him really, like, not as delivered is some of the Star Wars movies, but that's because
that's because of
Lucas.
The villain in the movie, I forget the name, the actor's name, but my god, his hilariously awful performance might make the movie worth watching, because every line is delivered so horribly that it's hilarious.
Oh boy, remake. I'm looking up the cast right now because I forgot who was in it. It's been years since that came out and I never saw it, so. So it's probably a right decision.
For good reason. It's a fucking awful movie that does it. Like, there's no reason to watch this over the original. It doesn't do anything better. It doesn't even do anything as good.
Oh, what a weird coincidence. Speaking of John Wick, Lance Reddick was in the movie.
Oh, yeah, he was. He had, like, a bit part. He was hilarious because he just had this minor part where he was just like, no, it's okay. I don't mind you. I'm not offended that you flirted with my girlfriend. I'm a big boy.
Oh. I'm still sad about Lance. He's such
too.
A talented actor. It didn't hit me as hard as it did when, like, Kevin Conroy passed, but it definitely hit me because I really liked him. He was such a cool guy.
Absolutely. As far as the Old Boy remake is concerned,
I won't watch it.
Yeah, no. In fact, I should just tell you one of the biggest fuck-ups of this film, and you'll kind of get why it didn't work. So the thing about the Old Boy remake is it tries to up, like, certain elements of the original. Like, instead of being locked away for 15 years as he was in the original, he's locked away for 20 in this remake.
Okay, I mean, that's a weird negligible.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean anything. Like, the thing about the original Old Boy is, like, he was locked up in, like, he was locked up in, like, the 90s at some point and got out in the 2000s. That's And when you think about just the differences between those two decades, they're vast. Like,
right. Yeah, there's a point for that.
Mm-hmm. And there's also kind of there is also kind of a big difference between in the remake as well, because, I mean, he also gets abducted in the 90s but comes out in the 2010s. So you think that'd be a bigger thing. But the two time periods don't feel different, and we don't get, like, any scenes that show – one thing I loved in the original is to show the transition of time. We see, like, the news reports and seeing all, like, the real-life events that were occurring during the time this character would be locked up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay. just as an example, they mentioned 9/11 at one point because that would have happened, like, around – during the time he was in confinement, so
mm-hmm. –
But we never got that. You never get that with the remake, and you never really get a sense of how long this guy's been locked up, and to the point where even though he's technically locked up for longer than the guy in the original, it feels negligible just with how it's presented. But another thing is, so I'm going to go into spoilers for the original Old Boy for anyone listening. So
I think it's an old enough movie and I've seen it. So yeah.
So, okay, so at the end of the original Old Boy, we find out that the female lead that he's formed this sexual and romantic relationship with is actually his daughter, and they were kind of hypnotized into falling in love with each other, and this was just the whole point of this guy's fucked up revenge plot.
Mm-hmm.
This movie kind of has the same twist, but, like... So the whole reason it happened in the original was, like, the guy was in an incestuous relationship with his sister, and they were caught. But in the fucking remake, it's a whole family of incest.
Oh.
And they were all caught, and the father just shotgunned all of the other family members and then himself. And the guy who wants revenge happened to survive. It's so dumb.
Oh.
I don't
what,
get
what
this.
What point does that make?
Like, nothing!
What does that serve?
Nothing!
Okay.
And here's the thing. Also, how the twist with the daughter is presented is much better in the original. Because in the original, they kind of resolve the daughter plotline quite quickly within the movie at first. Like, he finds out that, you know, they were adopted by another family. They're far away from here. And after that, he doesn't really bother to go after her because he at least knows she's safe. So he's going to focus on revenge.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a hard-hitting twist when suddenly the daughter plot comes back and it becomes the whole revenge of the villain. So,
right.
In the movie, it still keeps mentioning the daughter over and over again to the point where even if you aren't familiar with the original and know the twist, you'll figure it out. Like,
right. Like, Huh. What a weird change.
Mm-hmm. Also, the hallway fight, the way they do the hallway fight in the remake is fucking horrible.
Why, did they try and recreate it, or is it, like, changed up in, like, its shot composition, or is it...
So they try to do it in a similar way, like, there's kind of a similar shot composition, but it's so over... The best way I can describe the fight, the actual fighting itself, is over-choreographed, if that makes sense.
Oh, okay. Because, like, yeah, in the original one, it's very, like, brutal.
Mm-hmm.
It does feel very... I mean, it's very unrealistic, but it feels realistic. Do you get what I'm trying to say? Like,
Yeah. It's still, like, a fight where, like every... you believe that everyone's in that hallway is just beating the shit out of each other, so...
Right. Okay, yeah. Wait, do they try and make it flashy in the new one?
Yeah, they kind of do. They make it a bit – they try to make it flashy, but it has, like, some of the worst sound editing ever. Like, the hammer strike sound – have a very generic bam sound effect to them.
Oh, okay.
Hmm.
Yeah. I can understand trying to recreate it because it's such an iconic part of that first film. You know, I can understand from that perspective. But I also find making an American remake of Old Boy to be – a bad idea to begin with.
Yeah, and here's the worst part of it. So, it actually causes a plot hole because this set takes place in America. So, in the original took place in South Korea, so it made sense why they were mainly fighting with, like, blunt objects in their fists, because gun laws are strict in South Korea.
Right. That makes sense.
So, there's not a single gun in the American remake, and it's like, come on. It's like, no one in this hallway fight is breaking out a fucking pistol.
So no one's packing.
No one is packing. There is one, a few bits in that movie I found hilarious, but just because they were more, due to more observational humor for myself. Like, one of the bodyguards he takes out to go and interrogate Samuel L. Jackson's characters played by Rami Malek, and I just found that funny, so.
Oh, yeah, I saw his name pop up in the IMDb I was just looking at. And yeah, Elizabeth Olsen is in it.
Yeah, she's the, love interest slash twist daughter, so.
And I think the villain you talked about is Charlton Copley from,
Charlton Copley, yes. Yes, yeah. That is. Yes,
District
that was.
Nine.
Yeah, he was, his performance, he made decisions with this performance.
Okay.
I don't think they were good decisions, but by God, he made
decisions. Do you ever see Hardcore Henry?
I have not.
Oh, okay. He's like a major part of that movie, too. Which is a fun movie, but I heard if you have motion sickness, it's not great.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, also the bodyguard for the villain in this movie is played by Pom Clementeef, so.
Huh.
So, it is kind of, there was a point while I was watching this movie a couple years back where I was like, wait, we have Thanos, Scarlet Witch, and Mantis all in the same room. Okay, before, and this was like before a lot of those specific films came out, so.
Oh, she's coming in Mr. Impossible. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. God, she looks so different on the poster. Like, I was staring at the poster in the movie theater I work at, looking at her face on the poster of Mission Impossible, and for some reason my brain was like, who is that? I know her? But I'm not connecting dots, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And right now you just blew my mind. Like, I was like, oh, okay.
But yeah, so, yeah, the old boy remake is fucking awful. And if you are curious about certain aspects of it but don't want to watch the movie, I'd highly recommend the review of Your Movie Sucks from Your Movie Sucks. I think he did a very good job analyzing why the remake didn't work, but he's also splits it in between analysis of the original film. So you kind of get a nice back-to-back to see what exactly is going wrong here.
Well, you do kind of need the context of the original to be able to analyze mm-hmm. the changes made and why they don't work, you know? That actually makes a lot of sense to me. So that's probably really interesting. It's like I talked to you about, I forget his name, that one video that deconstructed the Pink Floyd's The Wall, but like the Nostalgia Critic Wall.
Oh,
one.
Fuck. Well, what was the guy's name? I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, but... yeah, you know who I'm talking about. Yeah, yeah. I'm blanking on even what his channel's name is, but I would say that first 7 minutes of that video is a really good deconstruction of the wall and why it's interesting. You know?
Right.
You know exactly who I'm talking about, though, right? Yeah.
Right. I'm just going to look up Nostalgia Critic The Wall, and I'll probably find it, honestly. It'll probably be, like, one of the first videos.
Is it Pulling Focus?
Sorry, what?
Is it called Pulling Focus? Is that what it's called?
I'm not sure. Hold on. Nostalgia Critic The Wall. Folding Ideas.
There we go.
And here's the funny thing. When I looked it up, I expected that to be one of the first things. I was expecting the actual review to be the first result, but no, it's the first results for Nostalgia Critic's The Wall are the Needle Drops video on it and Folding Ideas, and then the actual video.
I kind of love that because those other two videos are better.
Yeah, and they
like,
also
infinitely better.
And funny enough, they also have higher view counts than the actual video, so we could call this ratio.
Folding Ideas has a million more views.
Yeah, so yeah. It's like, God, if it was possible to ratio a YouTube video, I think this is how you do it.
Yeah, congrats on doing that. that's awesome. And how many of those views on the Nostalgia Critic one are just, like, hate watches so that they can, like, analyze how bad it is, you know?
How many of those views are just the ones that pause the video immediately and go into the comments?
Probably most of them.
Like, just because just because I will freely admit I've gone on that video a few times just to go into the comments because they are a riot. Like,
okay, I think I'm going to have to do that, but then I'm going to have to change the recommended settings on my YouTube so I don't get Nostalgia Critic videos. that's an oof. That's a big oof. But I am. Thank you for another movie for telling me to avoid. I'm not gonna watch the remake of Old Boy.
I can tell you plenty of movies to avoid. Like I've seen, as much as I try to watch strictly good movies, there are movies where, or at the very least, enjoyable ones. In the case of like some bad movies that I enjoy for different reasons.
I do love so bad it's good type movies, but sometimes movies are so bad, you know, or they're trying to be hard. Too hard to be so get bad they're good movies that they end up just being really unfunny in their attempt at trying that, you know. There's a level of self-awareness where it ruins the joke, if you get what I mean,
where a movie's trying to be kind of have that so bad it's good energy, but yeah, it's not. That's kind of how I feel about Sharknado, if I'm being real. Like, I know a lot of people enjoyed that one, but I just couldn't because it felt like it was – my philosophy is if you try to fail and you succeed, what did you accomplish?
I think the original Sharknado has the same energy level as a lot of the other Asylum films of that time period. I don't think they were thinking about it potentially being a hit. Or trying that. I think they were just making a movie, a really cheesy movie. But the problem was the sequels knew why people liked it. And so they tried to retroactively make that series that's so bad it's good energy. Like, and by doing so, they just got, like, kind of cringy. Do you get what I'm going
to? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I get exactly what you're saying though. Sharknado has never been a series that I consider to be a really good, so bad it's good type of film.
Right, you know? Right. They're, like, when I think of the films of so bad it's good level that I enjoy, like, Batman and Robin, Jupiter Ascending, The Room, Birdemic, they were all movies that people were legitimately trying to make a good movie, but failed. And that's where a lot of the appeal comes in. So
Troll 2, for example, you know?
Yeah, Troll 2 is another one.
Plan 9 from Outer Space is a classic one.
Oh, Plan 9's fucking fantastic.
Yeah, so those, I get exactly what you're saying, right? Because there's like an energy level to those type of movies where you can tell that the creators were passionate about what they were doing. You know? There is something to the genuine nature of art that makes those experiences fun. Do you get what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah.
It's like not manufactured that way. So, I mean, there's the reason why The Room is as big as it is because that film is very earnest. But
it is.
It just fails in every way.
Well, The Room is kind of It's interesting the more you learn about Tommy Wiseau as a person and just how he acted and, like, how he was kind of a shit and how much the film kind of reflects the creator in a way. So
it really does. It's a very misogynistic film, to be honest, but
it is like there's like it's funny. I saw a post the other day. I forget who said it, where it's like someone was like. Someone did one of those Joker memes where it's like, you know, oh, are you saying that The Room is bad? And it's like, I do, and I'm tired of pretending it's not. And I'm sitting here thinking, no one has ever said The Room is a good movie.
People have just said that they enjoy watching it because it's bad.
Right. Like, I hesitate to find someone who would say, I unironically enjoy The Room. I'm pretty sure anyone who would probably be incels just based on the content of the movie.
No, I like it because it's a very unique, fascinating, like, film, but also because it has a fascinating story attached to it, you know?
Yeah, it's a funny movie. There's a reason why this is kind of a cult classic in the so bad it's good market. There's a reason why I own this shit on Blu-ray. Like,
same. There's a reason why I went up to meet Greg and Tommy several times.
But yeah, no, it's like, but no, like I've never met anyone who enjoyed the movie unironically, mainly because you just can't. Everything about this movie on a technical level, on a writing level, on an acting level, all of it's bad. Like,
that's true.
And I think this is one of the few cases where you can say that rather objectively. Like,
I do recommend people actually read or listen to an audiobook version of Disaster Artist. I think even if, like, you aren't super into it, I think that is a really fascinating read. If you're looking for interesting people or are interested in film in general, I think it's worthwhile. Have you listened to it or read it or no? No.
I haven't. I still need to read it. I'll probably bring it with, you know, I've been thinking of bringing I have two books that I really want to read into that I'm probably going to bring with me on this Philly trip. The other one being, I'm Glad My Mom Died. So,
oh, cool. I hope you enjoy reading it. I hope you're also prepared for it being heavy.
I'm aware. I know the subjects it tackles, but yeah, I'm probably gonna bring those with me because I'm not gonna have game systems or shit, and video games are often my time killers. So
that's a good idea. The next books that I want to listen to, because I do better with audiobooks, I want to listen to Elliot Page's new book, Page Boy.
Nice.
Which I love trans stories, so I like to hear his life and his experiences. A book I read about like a third of the way into, I was borrowing physically from someone but had to give it back when I got fired from my last position. I wasn't fired, I was let go, because I actually was a really good employee, regardless, I'm not going to say it, but the title of it is The Teasler. I recommend reading it, because it's an autobiography by Laura Jane Grace, the lead singer of the band Against Me, and it's a very moving and very raw expression of trying to grow up. She's a little older, so growing up into a time when transness wasn't really a thing, outside of, like, at most, you would see occasional trans people on Jerry Springer Show as kind of, like, spectacles. So I still think I think from what I was reading so far, I need to finish it, was fantastic. She wrote a really deep personal memoir, in addition to, if you like punk music,
mm-hmm.
and like this music industry in general, it's totally worth reading. It's good. I don't say the word, but that's the name of the book, so you can find it on any audiobook store or bookstore anywhere, but you know exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I'm just giving some book recommendations. I don't read a lot, but I do like audiobooks. And when I've listened to them, I've always really enjoyed them. And I feel like, you gain a lot of perspective from reading, even if it's mm-hmm. audiobook form. I think it broadens your mind and horizons a bit, which I think more people need to do. especially with trans stories, you know, we need this space and the place to express our truths in a way that's more than just the usual just sound bites we get from, like, the occasional documentary they air on TV. You know what I mean? So it's worth checking out. I wanted to also bring up one thing I just remembered, because I was like, there was something in my mind that I had seen recently that I came away loving. So in LA there for a few weeks, a musical was being premiered. I really hope it moves on past the 1 4-week the 4 weeks of performances they did for it, because I thought it was phenomenal. So I saw a Transparent musical. A friend took me to that. And Jazzy, are you familiar at all with the show Transparent?
I've heard of it.
Okay, so it's an Amazon Prime TV show that I would say is worth watching because it was fairly revolutionary for the time it was on in terms of putting trans stories in that sort of fictional way front and center. Even though if it was made today and instead of in 2015 when it started, it wouldn't be a cis actor who played the lead character. Jeffrey Tambor, who famously sexually harassed some of the trans co-stars on that show and was kicked off for the finale, which is super shitty. But what's great is that this Transparent musical, like stage production, is a condensed and I honestly think heightened version of that show, done in a way with like really good songs, great performances, and most of the cast is trans.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, it was awesome. They did, so Catherine Hahn was in the show who played a rabbi who had a relationship with one of the characters. The musical version makes her a trans woman who's also a rabbi. So that was cool. They had a trans actress who played her. So I don't know if you know the story, but the concept is it's a Jewish family who lives in L.A. There's three main siblings. They're adults. And their parent comes out as a trans woman. And it's the simultaneously the family's reaction to that. It's also her reaction to as an older age, because she's in her 60s or 70s when she comes out, kind of dealing with the fact that she had to live so long in the closet. The siblings dealing with the fact that their parent is trans. But also one of the siblings coming to terms with their own gender identity. It's really powerful. It's really moving. And because it is a Jewish family, they do a great thing, which the TV show did too. The TV show, I'd say, was revolutionary in pointing this out, but the show had a flashback to Magnus Hirschfeld and the Institute of Sexology during Berlin in the 1930s. And the stage version does the same thing as sort of a way of one of the sibling characters to deal with their own discovery of their Jewish, understanding the Jewish roots in addition to their queer roots as a person.
Gotcha.
And I don't want to spoil things, but I would say what going to a musical show where most of the cast was trans people, playing trans people, telling a story about trans love and hardship was really moving during Pride Month. In a time with immense hate. But I also think the show was masterful the musical was masterful for like having these flashbacks to the time of the 1930s, because it's very obvious the parallel they're making between Nazi Germany and now. So if you want a show that's very queer, I really do recommend seeing this musical. I really hope, if you want me to send you clips, I can. There's a couple clips online, but because it was such a small, like, first run production of this, unfortunately, there's like no cast recordings. It sucks. I'm really upset because there's a lot of really good songs in it. There's promotional clips that they've posted, which I could share with you. But I do hope that this theater that it played here in LA goes beyond just Los Angeles and that we get a Broadway run of it. I'm crossing fingers for that.
Well, here's hoping.
Yeah, here's hoping the best for this little show. It's it was quite moving. It was really good. And I while watching it, I I realized I had never been in a room of as many trans people as there were, whether it be on stage and or in the audience. And, you know, when you grow up without, like, you understand this, when there's no representation for your feelings or who you are anywhere, it's very lonely and isolating. So it felt really nice.
Mm-hmm.
So, sorry.
It's all good.
Yeah.
But,
I just was getting a little emotional.
Yeah. Understandable.
Yeah. So,
but,
hopefully you get a chance to see it. I will share clips with you if you want to see that.
Okie dokie.
Yeah. I'll send you the clips I do have. It's funny. It's over the top. It's sad. It's moving. It's kind of like, it's a show that like tries to make you feel like everything at once, you know? Which I think is good. The biggest star on the show was, the famous drag queen and trans woman, Peppermint, who's a black trans lady, who in the show is also Jewish. Like all the characters are Jewish in the show. Mm-hmm. So totally, if you know who Peppermint is, she's kind of a big deal. So she was kind of like the biggest. Star.
I'm not overly familiar with the drag scene, so.
Oh, okay. She was on RuPaul's Drag Race.
And I don't watch RuPaul, so.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I don't pay attention either. I just know her through her friendship with Jazz Jennings.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of my connection. So she's a really good singer.
That's good.
I mean, most drag performers are good singers, so I guess that makes sense too.
Absolutely.
Also. I had never seen this before in a building, but the theater I saw it at was called the Mark Taper Forum over in Los Angeles, and there were signs on both the bathroom doors that specifically stated, this is a gender-inclusive bathroom. Use the bathroom of which you identify with. So I thought, I've never seen that before, and it felt really welcoming, too.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's Los Angeles, so I guess that makes a little bit
more
sense.
Yeah, they're typically more open for that sort of thing. But still, nice. It's nice to know I have a list of places I can go if this date goes south, so.
Yeah, you can come to L.A. and hang out with me.
If I can afford it.
Yeah.
But anyway.
I can barely fucking afford it.
Yeah. But anywho.
Yeah, no, I don't want to drag this on, but I wanted to at least bring this up on here because I don't see enough people talking about it, and I feel like this was just a huge creation of trans. And the people behind the scenes of the show are also trans, FYI. So trans art. So I wanted to, like, put it on a platform to, like, at least people Google it and watch the clips online. And I'm really disappointed that most of the clips don't pass – oh, barely over 1,000 views, and it needs more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway. I don't want to keep. Did you want to bring up anything else before we?
I think we can wrap things up. I'm a bit tired, so.
No. You're good to go. And so, sort of announcement. The temporary announcement that. That Jazzy, you're going to take a little bit of a hiatus from the show
for a month. Yes, I will. I'll basically not be back until August. So,
which is cool. We'll have some fun things planned when you get back. Until then, we will probably have some guest hosts and some fun stuff lined up while you're enjoying your career and all the good things in Philly and. All the stuff, so.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, anyway, do you want to plug where people can find you in the meantime?
As usual, you can find me on Twitter at Lady Jazzington, assuming that the people who always say that Twitter's dying are wrong as usual, but. That's just assuming. You never know. Could be right. They could be right this time. You can also find me on under Jazzy Oliver on YouTube, and you can find my website at www.jazzyolivervo.com.
definitely go follow Jazzy's stuff, as always. My name is Crystal Williams. You can follow me on Twitter at Crystal W Rocks. You can also go to my, I'm on Blue Sky. I don't know what my user ID is on there. If you look up Crystal Williams and you were invited into Blue Sky, it's crystalwrocks.bsky.social on there. But I have a bunch of other social media platforms, including Mastodon and Hive. So yeah, you can find me anywhere. And you can also